is Sunday, the 18th of May, 2014, and you're listening to Primordial Soup, where the soup is hot and everything is primordial. My name is Dion Barnard, and with me on the show tonight, all the way from Sweden, is my good friend Brian Coughlin, who you haven't heard for about 8 months. Brian, how's it?
Hello.
Yeah, and my other awesome, goodest, bestest friend in the whole world from Hilton, KwaZulu-Natal, is Charles Webster. I had a blank moment there. Charles, how are you doing?
Hey, Dion, it's good to be on again.
Thank you, Charles. Nice to see you. And we haven't heard from Anna yet, although she might pitch up a bit later. But we do have a rogue guest on the show in the form of Mark Ryan Rees, all the way from Rosebank, Johannesburg. Mark, how are you?
Bloody lovely, Dion. How you doing?
Welcome to the show, Mark. Mark was like, what the hell do you guys talk about? What is the show all about? He doesn't listen to podcasts, but he's now on one. And maybe he'll listen to a few of our back issues going forward. So, with no further ado, we're going to go on to how everybody's been doing, a bit of a catch-up. Brian, you've got an 8-month catch-up, which you'll have to do in exactly 1 minute.
Okay.
What's going on?
Most of it has really been to do with the fact that myself and Magdalena took on a drama project. We started attending a drama group in November, and
what do you guys know about drama?
Well, we were both in Covenant Players. Magdalene is actually a drama teacher and has subsequently done quite a lot more than I have in drama. So we started on that, and that's really what we've been doing really for all that time. It's been the major engagement, and then Rumble as well, of course. But the Rumble has to some degree fallen down the priority list, and actually now I'm trying to reboot that at the moment. It's not that it stopped or anything, but it's kind of stagnated a bit. So we're trying to do a bit of a reboot. So we'll see how that goes. So those are the two main things, of course, working and having to sort of, you know, do work and stuff. My daughter is in Australia and was having a great time and was traveling up the east coast of Australia. I think the east coast, or was it the west coast? Some coast, anyway. With a friend in a van they'd bought. They worked in one place for 5 months, and then they gathered quite a bit of money together, and then they were then traveling up the coast in this van. And then they met up with various friends on the way over several months and stopped off in Brisbane and were hanging out with some people. And then this girl, Josephine, and two other people that were in the apartment went off to shop or I don't know what, to do something. Marlon was back in the apartment, and Josephine had a huge accident with the van. The van was completely totaled, and poor Josephine was in bits, absolutely in bits.
Wow.
And she is in hospital now and has a broken leg, two broken ankles, a broken foot, a broken shoulder blade, and a broken pelvis. Yeah. So this 21-year-old girl is absolutely in absolute bits. So Marlon is staying in Brisbane now and visiting her daily in hospital. She's like getting better. She's spine and brain all fine. And she's 21, so we think she'll be okay. And she's definitely recovering. That's been about 10 days since the accident. So, that is pretty exciting.
Brian, is your daughter missing home yet?
She is a little bit, yeah. I was talking to her today actually, and she was kind of definitely wanting to get home. So we expect her to be home on the 19th of June. Assuming this other girl's mother is there in Australia now, and is a doctor as well, which is quite good, I guess. And we'll want to get her home as soon as possible. So, we hope then that Marlon's scheduled flight on the 19th of June, she'll just take it then and she'll come home. And this other girl will come home then in and around the same time.
Okay.
But it's a slightly tragic end to a very, you know, she's had a great time and these two girls really love each other and have been together for the best part of 6 months and 8 months maybe. I don't know, a long time. I mean, they met each other pretty much when Marlon arrived in Australia. And they are the best of friends, and there's countless photos of them hugging and showing themselves sort of climbing mountains and crap. And now this is just so tragic, you know. But
at least
she's fine. She's fine and we'll recover. But it's she was extremely badly injured. I mean, it was very serious. She had to be cut out of the van.
Well, Brian, it is really cool to hear your voice again back on the show.
Likewise.
And looking forward to a good season going forward.
Hallelujah. Amen. Glory to God.
May Thor be praised.
Yeah.
So, Charles, what's been going on in your life?
Well, apart from the usual daily activities, I'd have to say some of the highlights have been the fallout from my Christian apostasy. It's been real fun in what is really a community to have the people kind of, this is the kind of place where, you know, everybody waves at one another when they drive past one another in the street. And,
you're talking now about Hilton, Charles?
Yes, I am. And, so apart
from the metropolis of Hilton, where everyone knows each other, it's kind of like Cheers, but at a citywide level.
Where everybody knows your name, and going to the local supermarket is a bit of a social event. And, so apart from, you know, being called a Satanist by the more amusing and ignorant locals online, you know, they're now refusing to wave at me when they drive past me in the street. Of course, I'm deeply hurt by all that.
Hold on. When I drive around in the street, most people don't wave at me anyway.
That doesn't count. You drive around in Rosebank where no one gives a shit.
Well, anyway, now you know what it's like for me, man.
Yeah, now you know how the rest of us live, Charles. We drive around and people never wave at us. Bastards.
I know. It's terrible.
Yeah, but I know what you mean, though. I mean, it's lovely to live in that kind of community. But then if you step out of line with agreed community norms, the blowback can be quite nasty.
It really can be. And I mean, to the extent that apparently in the States, the implications for your social standing and even your job prospects can be quite dire if you come out publicly as an atheist, which I hadn't realized until, well, fairly recently. But it's definitely, I mean, and what I hadn't realized, because, well, we'll get onto the word of the week later, but atheism has pretty much always been meant as an insult. And that's something I didn't realize.
Oh, that'll be interesting to talk about. Yeah, Charles, of course, I've been keeping track with some of the ups and downs of that. And all I can say is it is a hard journey, you know. I mean, I went through it tremendously because I was in the community I was leaving. Brian went through it to an extent, less so because he just sort of left the community and said goodbye and didn't have to. Am I right, Brian?
Yeah, I sort of drifted. I sort of drifted quietly away. And then we moved to Sweden as well, which helped, because then I didn't really renew contact with the Christian community. Yeah. I just kind of quietly sort of drifted away, and then just began to realize that this had happened. And Magdalena had the same thing had happened to her kind of simultaneously.
It's just so, so different when you're living in the community. And as you say,
yeah,
the community is so small, and the displeasure of everyone is so in your face. I mean, you literally can't, it's like you or me, Brian, going to the local spa or Pick and Pay or whatever the non-South African equivalent of that is, Kmart, and bumping into someone who disapproves of our atheism is almost nil.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas for Charles, every day that he gets out of bed, drops his kids at school, he can meet these people. Goes to spa, he can meet these people.
It's hard to imagine. It really is hard to imagine. I mean, here it is not an issue, really. The equivalent in Sweden would be the local ICA.
Well, actually, Brian.
Yeah.
Gothenburg. I don't know what others. I mean, you've lived in other cities and stuff, but I find that this city is quite small, and what you do and what you say does impact you here a lot more than say, you know, that what I'm used to living in Montreal, which was twice or three times
city.
Bigger.
Yeah, I suppose Gothenburg is 500,000 people. So, I mean, like, you can go into Gothenburg and every fourth or fifth time you'll see somebody you know.
Yeah,
so that is true.
Oh,
but
no, I didn't realize Gothenburg was that small. I mean, that's the size of Benoni. You know, that's a small town.
No, but anyway, I do envy. It's a large city. It's the second largest city here. Let's not turn this into a dissing Gothenburg fucking podcast. Sorry, Charles.
just to put it into perspective for everybody here, I mean, Hilton has a total of 4,000 houses. So if your typical kind of nuclear family is four people, yeah. you've got a total of maybe 16,000 people in the village. I can take the dogs for a walk in the morning and be home by lunchtime having circled the whole village. So that's, but, you know, it's not, as you say, it's not a comparison. It is remarkable in your face. And, well, you know, that's why I started a local group of skeptics meeting together, because there are others, as it happens, like me, who are coming out of the woodwork and feel isolated.
So yeah, I kind of envy people whose apostasy is at least acknowledged and recognized, that you are being given the finger and not waved at when you're driving along. Because in my case, I grew up, in a family of Jews, and there's no way out of the religion. You know, I could say, I really don't believe the stuff, and I don't self-identify. And they say, oh, don't worry, you're Jewish anyway. We're still going to include you. And I'm like, I don't want you to include me. I mean, you can include me for the food. I'm happy to come for dinner, but just don't decide for me what my identity is. Don't decide for me that I'm Jewish. It's not a belief-based thing. I can stop believing. I'll still be Jewish.
Well, I mean, that is true. But on the flip side, it's just so hard to relate to, Charles's story in that situation. Because it's like having been part of a cult, effectively, and then leaving, you have a very similar journey, a very similar experience, But Charles, while we're still on you, Charles, I wanted to ask, because we'll come back to Mark and find out more about that very interesting, story. Charles, did you meet this week with your cosmic teapots?
Actually, we're due to meet in about 10 days' time. It's the week after next on a Tuesday evening, and we've had a bit of a gap. I was abroad on business and visiting family for a couple of weeks, so the gap between meetings is a bit longer than usual. But the people, signs are good, because the people are saying to me, hey, when are we meeting again? We're missing the meeting. And we've had a few extra people join, the Facebook group. And, in a tiny place like this, if we can get together 8 or 10 people on a regular basis, it's a real achievement. So the signs are
good.
So
that's what you're calling it, the cosmic teapots. It's quite a good name.
Yeah, obviously, it's an allusion with respect to the great Bertrand Russell's cosmic teapot, and it seemed like a nice kind of just a generic kind of name for a group that's generally about questioning and so on.
Nice.
Yeah.
Anna, how's it going with you?
Pretty good. Want me to tell you about my week? It's been pretty slow since I've been, I'm not working right now. So I did get out. I hung out with friends and stuff.
When you say you got out of bed or you got out of your house?
I actually managed to get out of my house.
That's great to hear.
I don't know. Believe it or not, it's actually quite hard when you're jobless. You just don't really have a goal. I mean, you have to be so strict with yourself to actually remind yourself, because when you work, it's part of your whole routine. You get up, you get go to shower, you take the bus, you get to work, you drink some tea or coffee or whatever, you work, then you go out with your coworkers to lunch, you socialize, go back. So it's like a big routine. But if you're not part of that anymore, you actually have to think about that stuff. So I forget to eat, I forget to drink, I forget to get out. Mainly I'm, looking for work and reading things at the same time, working on my portfolio. And, I remind myself to do these kind of, I have a routine where I run twice, 3 times a week and do some exercises and stuff. But, it gets kind of crazy. I mean, I literally forget to drink, and then I get a headache, and I wonder, why do I have a headache? And then someone tells me, did you drink today? I forgot.
Yeah, you'd hear that a lot from us. But for what it's worth, we're all holding thumbs and other equally scientifically verifiable
appendages.
means of making the thing happen.
Well, I mean, I did get sort of, it's not 100% confirmed, but an old boss of mine sort of contacted me out of the blue again. just when I lost my job and he had a job offer, I could probably do it long distance for a month. You know, I'll have pretty good pay. Just need to, like, tie up basically, you know, I already confirmed, but he just needs to tell me what he actually wants me to do, because he wants me to do it, like, in a month's time. And you know, that's something. And, so I keep on keeping on, sort of.
Good. Yeah. Well, we'll keep checking in on your progress.
Yes.
And Mark Ryan Reese. Now, Mark, you know, that what Anna was just talking about, something you're very familiar with, is knowing how to be unemployed with structure or not. And you can tell us how that works. But, Mark, tell us a bit about yourself. Who are you? Why are you even here?
I'm here because you asked me to come. And I spend my days and my nights pursuing pleasant trivialities and mini projects wherever I find them, mostly as a matter of distraction. Very few of them are important, and so tonight I'm here at the podcast. I'm a ne'er-do-well, a wastrel, and a layabout, and I have been for many years since I stopped studying philosophy. After I did my master's in that, I thought to myself, what shall I do with my life? And I couldn't think of an answer, so I decided that I was going to take a year of leisure just to contemplate this. And so I took this year in leisure, and at the end of it, I reflected, and I realized that leisure was my calling all along.
Wow. That sounds great, buddy.
And what Anna says is correct. You know, you need to plan your days. Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to wake up late and be all depro. That's no way to live.
Yeah, exactly.
I know what I'm doing tomorrow and the day after and 3 weeks from now. Basically, who I'm seeing at coffee shops to drink effeminate coffee.
Effectively, every time I ask Mark, what have you been doing over the last few days? It usually starts with the words, "Well, I met," and then he proceeds to tell me who he met. And if you've ever walked around with Mark Ryan Reese, who has become a legend, and hence the name Mark Ryan Reese and nothing shorter than that, he is the kind of guy that you'll be having coffee with in Rosebank at some really interesting little coffee spot, and in will walk the grandson of Nelson Mandela, and they'll be on name terms and patting each other on the back, you know. So it's like this type of daily engagement.
One of the things I like to do is I do like to go to coffee shops or wherever it is, and I often go with the intention of reading my book, and I get like two words in, and I see who's sitting around me, and I say hello to them. And what I like to do is escalate from small talk to medium talk within 5 minutes. We talk about our hopes and our dreams and how we take our martinis and all that sort of thing. And if we've revealed too much to each other, then we don't become friends. We don't stay in contact.
You just hope the other guy just forgets everything.
Exactly.
So Mark, you, in all these leisure sort of activities that you've been involved in the last several years, you've sort of developed a few little nuances that are quite uniquely yours. The way you keep your facial hair, for instance. Tell us about that, because that's quite important to you, as far as I can tell.
The beard. I believe that I'm favored by the gods with a such as Thor and Crom.
so you have to understand, Mark has a serious set of facial hair. Okay, which he grooms just so.
It's huge, and they're very distracting to people. They're like these massive. It's like boobs on my face.
Oh, wow!
And I've got to keep reminding.
I'm looking this up right now.
Face boobs. No, it's horrible. Like, you know, I'd be out and say hello, hello, and like eyes up here, buddy.
Yeah, yeah, really? Exactly. Yeah,
yeah. You know, there's a human being beneath this.
Underneath this hair. Yeah.
So Mark is certainly a philosopher. A really interesting guy to talk to. Has an opinion about pretty much anything and everything, and is an atheist, you know, in any legal sense of the word. But comes out of a very non-evangelical background. So tell us a bit about your sort of religious background and how God has been or not been part of your life.
Oh, well, it really hasn't been. You know, I went to come from a family of Jews, went to a
And these are sort of secular Jews, or you know, just...
But as many Jews are in the modern world,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
You could be an atheist and a Jew, in the sense that you identify as a Jew, you're concerned about the rituals and the sense of community and that sort of thing, and yet you don't believe in the existence of a God. I happen not to particularly identify nor believe in the existence of a God or any God at all, nor the supernatural.
I have a question regarding Judaism and stuff. I keep having kind of discussions of what Jewish is. You know, is it a religion or is it an actual people? And it seems like some people tell me, no, no, it's just religion and people just can convert to it or become Jewish. Then others tell me, not really, you know, especially if you're like an Orthodox Jew and you can never convert unless you're both your parents are Jewish or something, and what does that mean, you know? Like, so are they Jewish because of their religion? And then there's this whole thing with Ashkenazi Jews and what's the other?
Sephardic. And there's more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's all these tribes of Jews. So, I mean, there is some kind of I don't know what to call it, not nationality, but you know, some kind of a biological component to this, you know? So what is it? I mean, is it both? Is it
one? I'd go along the lines of saying it's all of that. It's definitely those components to it. There's a belief system. There's the dogma. There's the rituals. There's the sense of identity. There's the community. There's the history behind it, and all of that comes out of it. And it could be you can take one of those away, and a person's still Jewish, or. And unfortunately, you can take most of that away, and some people will still consider a person to be Jewish merely because along their maternal lines, their mother, grandmother, etc., they were considered to be Jewish. And so it might not be an ideological thing, but there's the ideological component to it too. So I really don't know the answer. I would take the neutral ground and say it's kind of all of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of stewing pot, almost a bit of primordial soup of all sorts of ideas and concepts. And yeah, I've certainly met so many Jews that are Jews for different reasons, different reasons from each other. You know,
yeah,
one will say, no, he's definitely Jewish, but really all he means is he was born to a Jewish family. And another guy will be Jewish because he has some sort of love of Jewish scripture, or he does the Shabbat on a Saturday or whatever it is.
But the thing is, to me, I mean, because I know I've spoken to Dion a lot. He came from a very, very religious, fanatical background. And so for him, religion is a big deal. He really hates it. I'm kind of religion friendly because it was never really shoved down my throat. I haven't had terrible experiences with it and stuff to resist.
Mm.
I guess
the whole Jewish thing is just on a big continuum, and it's a kind of a political religious continuum. And you have, you know, extreme Orthodox Jews who won't fucking turn off lights on Sunday and or Saturday, whenever the day is.
Yeah.
And then you have other people who don't give a shit about any of that stuff. So it sounds to me like you were on that end of the continuum, the kind of very relaxed, not really that serious, let's have a bar mitzvah kind of Jewish person.
Which I believe I was tricked into, by the way, into having a bar mitzvah. Yeah, so it's this huge trick where they tell you that in order to have your bar mitzvah, you need to have this huge party and wear like a suit that's two sizes too large for you and sing from the Torah in front of everyone, which is embarrassing. Whereas, and I've spoken to some rabbis about this, the entire thing, all you have to do to be bar mitzvah is turn 13. That's all there is to it.
But what is it? What is a bar mitzvah? I don't even know what the definition is.
It's a coming of age.
It's like confirmation.
It's a coming of age.
Yeah, it's for a rite of passage. Yeah,
yes.
But not even a rite. All you need to do is turn 13 and then you become religiously a major.
Okay. You go from boyhood to adulthood, effectively.
Okay.
A lot of the evangelical churches, I don't know, Brian, if you saw any of this in your experience with the church, because yours was similar to mine, but a lot of the evangelical churches have taken that concept and Christianized it.
Mm.
So there are a lot of evangelical churches now, especially cell-based churches, that are doing a rite of passage type thing for boys who turn 13, with, of course, you know, baby Jesus in the room and whatever. But
it just sounds a bit like confirmation to me.
Well, what? Confirmation is not an age-based thing. Confirmation is an acknowledgement of faith. That's what confirmation is.
It tends to happen, well, now though, I mean, it tends to happen at a particular age, and it's not that big a deal in terms of the acknowledgement of, I mean, it's become more ritualistic, really. In fact, Marlin, when she was, you know, thinking about being confirmed, we discussed it, and she decided not to be confirmed. And then several years later, she was very put out about the whole thing, because she was saying, you didn't tell me that people gave you money. You didn't tell me that you got a whole bunch of money from your relatives when you got confirmed. Nobody mentioned that fact, Dad. I was like, oh,
you know what?
Sorry, I thought it was, he was seriously considering your religious. He was like, yeah, but I mean, I still wanted the money, obviously.
Sorry, Charles.
No, I was just going to say, Dion, I'm busy reading Robert Bly's book, Iron John, at the moment.
Yes.
And I don't know if you guys have read it, but...
I haven't, no.
One of the points he makes in there... is that we have this actually this lack of rites of passage for men these days, and particularly since the Industrial Revolution. And so there's a two-pronged statement I'd like to make here. The one is I think there's something to the whole bar mitzvah type thing, which I think we lack in our culture, which is the rite of passage and the ability for a father to kind of teach his son about what it means to be a man and all that. And I don't want to go down that road too far, but the other thing I wanted to say or ask was whether you guys would agree with me that it almost seems as if the older a particular religion becomes, the more secularized its nature and its rituals, because it's like, you know, the bar mitzvah kind of happens to everybody, as Mark was saying. And it seems to me like the older Christian faiths are the same. You know, you get, I mean, Jesuit priests who are flagrant atheists, really. In their old age, if you speak to them, and they're completely secular in their values, and other groups like the Anglicans, and whereas the younger evangelical kind of fire and brimstone types, they're kind of into the hardcore, you know, absolute truth stuff. And I don't know what you guys think of that, but it seems to me as if it's the age of a faith or a religion seems to be directly proportional to its kind of mellowing and move towards a more secular feel.
I think that there is an element of that, but I mean, obviously, if you actually took all the religions on planet Earth today and looked at the fanaticism in some of the older religions like Hinduism, there's still a lot of fanaticism there. So it's more that certain, in my view, it's more that certain sects or denominations of religions sort of just embarked on a journey of becoming more socially acceptable and try to keep up with. You know, it's always for all these religions, it's always a keep up thing. You know, they always have to keep up with what secular society ultimately discovers. Like, slavery is wrong. Okay, we better keep up with that and change our doctrines. But not all of them do. So some of the older ones, you know, still haven't done that. I mean, Islam's a classic case in point. They're a fairly older religion, in terms of, you know, comparing them to the young religions of evangelicalism or Mormonism or so forth, but still have enormous fanaticism in it. But some of the sects of Islam, some of the population of Islam has just adopted a more secular worldview and effectively distanced themselves from the crazy blow themselves up people.
I think basically religion evolves, ironically. And that's what happens. Some of them evolve to a higher, more transcendent state, and others of them just stay the way they were. Sorry,
I should have qualified my statement more. I was really thinking more in the Western world. I mean, you're absolutely right, Dion. Obviously, a religion's ability to be kind of pragmatic and secularized is also highly dependent on the society in which it finds itself.
Sure.
I mean, you're just not going to be a secular Muslim in Iran right now. You're just not.
No.
So, for sure. No, you can be,
but you can't be one openly.
Well, as we'll find out in our story later.
you can't be one and survive.
Yes, precisely.
Mark, this is an impressive beard.
Show me what you're looking at.
Send the link.
You've got to see the one particularly with the eyeshadow.
Send the link.
I often doubt whether I really deserve my beard. Like, I thought to myself, like, I've never wrestled a giant predator to death with my bare hands.
But you could do it with your beard.
I could do it with my beard, yes. But do I deserve the beard?
Yeah, I want to see this beard so bad.
Charles, are you sending the link? Ah, there we go. Okay, going to look at Mark Ryan.
Oh,
what's with the makeup?
There was this thing going around where everyone was having these no makeup selfies to protest against some lady thing like boob cancer or endometriosis or rape or whatever. And so, like, all the ladies on Facebook were taking photos of themselves with no makeup on as selfies, as to show their solidarity.
Okay.
And
so
I was
decided to wear some makeup.
Cheekily subverting that. I don't remember what the cause was.
Jesus, that's the real thing.
Now, if it puts you at ease, the makeup itself, I wasn't wearing any. I photoshopped that on afterwards.
Okay. Uh-huh. We've all been exposed to Ms. Wurst recently, so I guess I'm okay. This would have shocked me if it had been before that, but now I'm okay now.
How does one retract a Facebook friend request?
It's also, my beard's also much larger now.
Much larger.
Yeah, it is. It is bigger. It's bigger than
that. Yeah, already. That's
seems
tiny
to extend
beard.
All the way down to your chest from this picture.
No, look at the size of that beard. That's tiny. That's a woman's beard.
Oh, okay. Good grief. So even when women have beards, they get denigrated. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, Mark has no reason to speak. He's a ginger. He's unemployed.
True.
He's a Jewish atheist. I mean, come on. It does. I mean, if I break his leg, he's got it all. You know what I mean?
Jewish atheist.
And so, Dion, how was your week?
Oh, yeah. Dion, your week. How was
it? Now that you mention it, it was great. There are a couple of main highlights. Number one, I've been sort of semi-promoted. When I say semi, I've been promoted but without pay. So that's where the semi comes in. But I've now taken on a sort of project management job in this whole move management thing, and I'm really quite enjoying it. So loving the extra stimulus, and I find myself quite enjoying the project management sort of role. I think it suits me quite well. So loving that, it's made my week a lot more interesting. And then we did go LARPing, funnily enough, Brian.
Yeah.
Went LARPing, did a wonderful adventure. Heather and I went off LARPing, and there was a twist. So I had organized with the LARPing masters, with the plot of our LARPing group, that I would propose to Heather during my LARPing. And they set it all up for me that we were imprisoned, our two characters. My character's an elf called Alarion. Her character's an elf called Isilwyn. And we were imprisoned in a dwarf dungeon, and then during a dialogue that happened between us and the prisoner, the guard, I declared my undying love to Isilwyn in character, and then got on my knee and pulled out an actual ring, and in character proposed to Isilwyn. Heather was quite confused at the time, going, wow, I didn't know anything about this.
Wow, he's really got the great legs to do this thing.
And then I put my hand against my head, as we do when we are now going out of character, and said, I'm also doing this in real life, by the way, will you marry me? And she burst into tears, and it was wonderfully romantic, and we got married in costume and in character.
Oh,
so not married,
got
but
married
engaged,
right there and then.
Engaged.
Okay.
So the marriage will be similar. We're busy plotting and planning it now, probably toward the end of the year, and we'll do it in Lord of the Rings style. We're planning to do it in full costume with wenches serving chunks of meat and larps and lyres and all sorts of interesting things.
God, it sounds wonderful.
And I was hoping that we could convince you, Brian, to come and join us for that.
Oh, so would love to do it. So would love to do it. But we're just financially not in that situation, unfortunately. But when is it?
We don't know, but we'll keep you updated. Maybe it's time to open a fixed deposit account somewhere and start saving. But, so that was the highlight of my week. I'm very excited. As you know, I was quite cynical about marriage and weddings when I got divorced, and had been for years afterwards. But knew in my heart that if I got to a point where I knew that I could do it on my terms, on our terms, you know, and not have to follow any societal norms about the thing, and yeah. we could do it for our own reasons.
Yeah.
We were doing it for the right reasons, and that would be awesome. And that's the point we've got to. So I'm very excited about it. Very, very happy to be going down this road.
Something I've often wondered about is why religion involves itself in marriage.
Hmm.
Like, why can't marriage just be a secular thing? About washing the dishes, you know, religion doesn't really involve itself too much in that. And it doesn't involve itself in contracts between you and the bank. Well, not all religions, but some do, but mostly not. And we don't see, and people who, like Christians, for instance, don't see it as a problem. Mm. That they don't involve themselves in that. But yet marriage, for some reason, seems to be like this very, what makes it so special? What makes it relevant?
The sex.
To religion.
I'm thinking it's pretty much the sex, really.
I think it's power. I think it's power. I think a religion needs to perpetuate itself, Mark. And two of the resources it needs are people and money. And so it exerts control and influence in the personal lives of its members. And I mean, what better way for the Catholic Church to perpetuate itself than to ban contraception? You know, and what better way for the church to support itself and gain power than to ask people for tithes? So for me, that's the short answer.
You're so cynical.
I think that there's a good explanation in one of the news articles that Dion has sent us, and that is about this woman who married a Christian. And she wasn't, it wasn't recognized. I mean, we'll get to that story eventually.
Charles, have you got a word of the day for us?
I do, Dion, amazingly. And, you know, I don't mean to sort of get cliched about this, but the word is atheism. And the reason why I chose atheism is A, it's front of mind and it's kind of easy to find on Wikipedia. And B, just because there's never-ending debate, and we've all had them, and I'm sick to death of them. The one about who has the burden of proof when it comes to the existence or non-existence of God. And so I thought I'd just share a definition that could put everyone at ease because, in fact, it appears that atheism includes both of those positions. In the one position, there is a burden of proof, and in the other position, there isn't. There are different kinds of atheism, unsurprisingly, but as I mentioned earlier, atheism has pretty much always been a pejorative. It comes from a Greek word, atheos, and this was used as an insult for those who rejected the gods that were worshipped by a larger society. So, you naughty, naughty atheists.
Uh-huh.
Now, there are two main types of atheism. The first is positive atheism, also known as Gnostic atheism, and this is the one where people actually assert positively, proactively, that there is no God. The other type of atheism, also called agnostic atheism, is the one where the person simply withholds the belief in the existence of a deity and does not explicitly assert that there is none. So if you're getting your knickers in a twist about who has the burden of proof, it really comes down to the particular argument that you're engaged in. If somebody comes to you and says there is a God, they are making an assertion. And if they come to you and they say there is no God, then they're also making an assertion. And there are varying degrees of efficacy with which you can argue the one case or the other. Personally, I'm an agnostic atheist, but it's really just a nominal thing. For most atheists, I think, you know, whether they're Gnostic or agnostic, the reality is you live as if there is no God, even if you can't be absolutely sure. And, of course, the classic example here is the tooth fairy, because you can't prove that there's no tooth fairy either. So it's really a nominal thing. There is a really interesting world out there of proofs or arguments for Gnostic atheism, And probably the most elegant one I've found, and the easiest one to argue if this is something that you are intent on engaging in, is the argument that relies on incompatible premises. So, for example, if someone is arguing that there is a God who is both omniscient and omnipotent, then these two terms are logically incompatible, and therefore it is it's easy to deduce that there can be no such God. So when people become really specific and start assigning specific character traits to the particular God that they're trying to convince you of, then it becomes a whole lot easier to basically argue against their proselytizing and make your case.
So, Charles, I think what's so important here when we have this conversation, because with so many, particularly Christians that I've had this conversation with, it all ends up being the more they get pushed into a corner, the broader, the less personal characteristics they assign to God. But they always start off with, and the thing that we're rejecting is the belief in the existence of a deity. And when we say deity, when the vast majority of atheists use the word God, they're talking about the God of the Christians,
the Bible,
or the God of the Muslims, or the gods of the Hindus. They're talking about a God with a whole bunch of human silly characteristics that are, as you say, contradictory and so forth, effectively defining a teenage girl or man, let's put it that way. And they so this is what ends up taking place. You say, no, I don't believe in God. It's silly, because, and when we say that, we're talking about the guy on the throne who's invisible in the sky in heaven, who decides what position you should have sex in. That's what we're meaning. And then, of course, the get out of jail free for the theist is, yes, but then who created the world and so forth? And it starts getting into less particular characteristics and more general, like, well, there has to have been some first mover, some big powerful being that caused it all, that was intelligent and so forth. And you're saying your definition is becoming so amorphous that it becomes irrelevant. If you're saying there may have been something that caused the universe, then I'll say, yeah, of course,
yeah,
there's
sure,
something
maybe
that caused the universe. You
yeah,
know, maybe.
It's just not your God.
But you're not talking about the God of the Bible when you say that, you know? So the whole word atheist, and I like the little bit you were talking about on it having been like a derogatory term, because it still very much is, isn't it? When someone calls you an atheist, it comes with a sense of venom. It comes with a sense of, like,
evil.
You're dirty, you know.
Yes, and that's the reason why a lot of people these days prefer to categorize themselves, if forced into a corner, as humanists, because, you know, humanism has a positive sense of meaning to it, and there's a sense in which you're working towards the betterment of mankind and creating a moral structure that doesn't rely on a God. But you're absolutely right. Theists will tend to compare apples and oranges. For example, the other day I was engaged in a debate with one who was trying to tell me that, you know, my position relied on faith because, for example, there's no absolute proof of an external reality outside my brain. And of course, you know, it's very difficult to compare that kind of argument, which has no real practical purpose, to, for example, saying, well, you know, I require evidence. To say that I don't require evidence because I can't prove or I can't prove that there's a world outside my brain, just the level of reliance on evidence is I'm tying myself in knots here, guys.
we know where you're going. But
yeah,
it's
basically
a statement. Yes.
The more you press religious people, the more they obfuscate, and sometimes it's not even on purpose. It's just because they have to. They realize themselves that that Jesus is God and the Trinity and the Holy Spirit, and then Jesus' father killed himself, but it was really him. And you start getting into the detail of that, and even religious people kind of beginning to go, Jesus, this shit is really absurd, you know? And so they retreat to this amorphous, fuzzy, nebulous concept, because you can't strike at that.
No, it might be okay.
You're striking at gas, yeah.
No,
yeah,
it might be okay for them not to have like a perfectly detailed conception of their god.
That is okay, but generally, when the Jehovah's Witnesses knock on your door, they're not knocking on your door because there's a vague formless force that created the universe. They have a very specific view of what's going on and who this person is and all these things you have to do, and they're engaging in particular acts to propitiate deity and shit, you know. If a religious person has a very vague, fuzzy, all-embracing view where they say anybody, you know, God loves us all and all religions lead to God in one way or another, well, I don't really have a beef with that person. I think they're still wrong, but that kind of vague, amorphous God, maybe they do exist. I still think there's significant problems.
Well,
with
the important part of that statement is that that's not a dangerous religion.
That's right.
It ceases to be problematic when you're into that...
Ecumenical.
Yeah, but not even ecumenical. It goes further these days into the, I'm losing my vocabulary here.
Panspermia, something or other.
Did I hear you say sperm?
Panspermia, sorry.
Just throwing us off track here now, man.
Yeah, I know.
But universalist. There's this whole universalist movement going on. And I mean, you can go to a universalist atheist church, which exists. We've done them on our podcast. Universalist atheist church, which is really a bunch of people who come together and do ceremonies that they don't ascribe any supernatural force to.
But they still have meaning.
But have meaning to them. And then you can go to a universalist Anglican church who have ceremonies which they ascribe some amorphous meaning to that is as meaningless as anything else. Yeah. And they're almost exactly the same ceremony. You know, there's no harm. It's the equivalent of me going and doing live action role play on a Saturday. You know, it's fantasy and it's meaningless to the local accountant or sports jock, but it's meaningful to me, you know. Nobody gives a shit about that religion. I mean, the folk that we tackle on the show are the evangelical, hardcore, literal believers.
Yeah, I mean, when people...
Because that's where the danger lies.
If the guys in your LARPing group started to insist that orcs really fucking existed, and we need to get the... We have to do something about these fucking orcs, people! Then that's a problem. And that's essentially what religion is.
The way I tackle usually the question of, well, the word atheism, because I have gone through this process, you know, I read up about all these definitions of atheism and, you know, which is which, and I decided to basically approach it from this, because I don't generally initiate these discussions. It's always someone else that comes to me and kind of is surprised, oh, you don't believe in God or the soul or something. So they asked me to explain or something, and then I would ask him, for example, you know, if they say, oh, you don't believe in God, so then I ask them, well, what do you mean by God? Please define that. And when they start defining that, then I understand what they mean, and then I can definitely say to them, you know, oh, well, I'm, you know, I don't believe in that, or I don't believe that exists or something, so I'm atheist towards that, rather than just sort of assuming what they mean by God. And like you like we usually do, and I used to do as well, like when people say, and generally that is what they mean. They're talking about the God of the Bible, because most people I know are Christians or some sort of a very loose, they drifted from Christianity towards some sort of spiritualistic New Age belief, and coupled with some kind of Buddhist or Hinduistic notion of, you know, God is everything, and, you know. Yeah, so basically it's always like I sort of start off by asking them what they mean, and then I can tell them my position on that, rather than saying, yes, I'm an atheist.
Absolutely.
Against
I think that's a very positive way to do it. I mean, the other night I thought I had started on the amorphous, and then it became very specific. I was talking to a friend of mine who really does believe that Lucifer in body fell from the sky and then became, you know, he was an angel of light rejected by an evil god and blah, blah, blah.
And I mean, the specifics were so specific as to be ludicrous, you know. And then I just took them each apart one by one. You know, we just looked at the metaphysical, you know, nature of each one of the things he was trying to describe to me. And even at the end of the night, I think he thought they were a bit absurd. But it is useful to know what the hell you're describing when you describe it. There is one other element of this I'd like to talk about, and that is the difference between atheism and agnosticism. Because the average Joe Soap actually doesn't know the difference. There are very few people I've spoken to who accurately understand the difference between what it means to be an atheist and an agnostic, and that you can be both at the same time. And you highlighted that by your positive and negative atheism, Charles. The idea is that you either know something or you don't know it. And most skeptical atheists are of the kind that don't claim to know there is no God. They're of the kind that go, well, we don't have evidence to justify a belief in God. And while the evidence is out or not in, we will continue to act as though there were no God. The conclusion that there is probably no God is what makes them an atheist. That's a conclusion. The underlying philosophy that we need, extraordinary evidence to back up this extraordinary claim, that's agnosticism. And that's very different to someone who claims to know there is no God, because that is a crazy, that's like a very different, that's a very different standpoint. And what comes to mind here is Richard Dawkins' scale. You know the scale I'm talking about. He has a scale from like 1 to 10, and he refers to people as being, you know, I can't remember which side of the scale he starts. I think 1 is not believing in God, and 10 is definitely believing in God. So 10 would be someone who really knows that God exists, and 1 would be someone who really knows that God doesn't exist, and everybody's somewhere on that continuum. But to me, that's his continuum of atheism, and I kind of disagree with that. I think that's a continuum of agnosticism or Gnosticism, and not of atheism. And the it's the conclusion you come to that determines whether you're an atheist or not. Because all that atheist means is you either do or don't believe in God. You know,
define which God exactly.
Yeah, you're right, Dion.
In a deity.
The agnosticism is really about knowledge and the extent of knowledge versus faith. And I think to summarize what I was trying to say earlier when I was tying myself up in knots so much is when people accuse you of requiring faith in order to justify your atheism because you can't answer one of the universal philosophical questions that cannot be answered ultimately, like, is there a reality outside my brain? It's very different to accusing them of requiring faith to believe in a God who creates a world in 6 days, or who is willing to promote marriage to underage girls, or who claims to send talking donkeys or satanic snakes that also speak to lead the world into destruction.
Yeah.
So that for me is the apples and oranges discussion.
Thanks, Charles. Nice one. It's time for Nerd Minute. Okay, and in Nerd Minute tonight, we are talking about something super exciting, super wonderful. In fact, you may think it's Superman we're talking about, and it is. It's Batman versus Superman, the movie coming out in 2016. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're not excited about this, you are not a DC fan, and there is something wrong with you. Batman versus Superman. Now, why am I so excited about this, Mark? Tell me why.
Because, first of all, you love Batman.
Oh, yes.
In fact, I've heard that on some level, Dion, you want to be Batman. And
you know what? I think he is Batman already.
He needs more money. or something.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
And less cheer.
Yes. No, I'm so not Batman. Okay. And I'm not Batman.
And also,
you have love, to speak like this.
You love Superman.
I do love Superman, yes.
And you're hopeful that in this movie, you'll get to see them kiss.
Oh, my God. Is this some sort of a gay dream or something?
This is not a bromance between Batman and Superman, people.
It's not gay. Why can't one man just celebrate another man's strength?
This is not Brokeback Super people.
I'm certain that Superman will break someone's back when he...
Oh, that he can.
Brokeback Planet.
So, folk, if you're not sure why this is exciting, firstly, you're listening to the wrong podcast. Secondly, Batman vs. Superman is a highly anticipated movie among all the fan people of the DC universe. Now, most people don't know that Batman and Superman are not Marvel characters, because people seem to have this idea that there's the Marvel universe and there are Marvel movies which include all superheroes that exist. And of course, that's not true. Marvel and DC are two competing universes, two competing franchises and companies that have their own set of heroes. In the Marvel universe, you have the well-known Avengers, Hulk, Thor, and the beautiful...
Fantastic Four, I think, right?
And, yes, absolutely. Scarlet Witch, the X-Men, Fantastic Four, Silver Surfer. These are all Marvel heroes, right? Those are not DC heroes. DC heroes revolve around the big crew, the Justice League of America. And they are Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, and Flash, and Cyborg. These are the guys that I have followed since I was a kid, right?
Spider-Man?
So I've got... No, Spider-Man is Marvel.
Okay.
Spider-Man is Marvel. So until now, the big DC franchises on movies have been Batman, which was really, really successful. So the Batman Trinity with Christian Bale that came out, Heath Ledger died making the movie where he was the Joker in Batman. Unbelievably good movie. The Superman franchise and the Henry Cavill Superman that just recently came out was fantastic. I loved it. Lots of airtime there on Krypton, and Russell Crowe was in it. It was absolutely fantastic. And of course there was the Green Lantern, which I loved with Ryan Reynolds, but a lot of people didn't. But these are the DC heroes, and until now, they've never been together in the same movie. So Marvel have done a great job of pulling all their heroes together, like the X-Men, a whole group of heroes together, like the Avengers. Really, really, probably the best superhero movie that's ever come out is the Avengers. Unbelievably good. But we've all been waiting for the Justice League of America, for DC to bring out a group movie. And... it was on the cards. It is now off the cards. We're all very sad about that. But what they've decided to do instead is lead up to the potential of it in a few years to come. So what they're doing now is they're doing a Batman versus Superman movie with Henry Cavill, the Superman we know and love from the recent Superman movie. And they are doing Ben Affleck as Batman. So Ben Affleck did an absolutely cuck job at the Marvel movie Daredevil, but we all have great hopes that he'll do a much better job at Bruce Wayne. He's quite seasoned. He's actually quite a good actor.
And he's had time to grow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're hoping for good things there. And they'll have the Lois Lane, Amy Adams, who was in the last Superman movie. But what's really exciting about this is they're going to start bringing out some of the other heroes as well. So Wonder Woman's making an appearance. She's being played by Gal Gadot, and she is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, if you go and just check out her images on Google, she is going to be a great-looking Wonder Woman. I'm not sure what her acting abilities are like. And Jesse Eisenberg... the guy who played the Facebook
Zuckerberg.
What was the name of the Facebook movie? The Social Network, I think it was called. So he's playing Lex Luthor, the supervillain Lex Luthor.
Wait, and, this is the guy that played Mark Zuckerberg. He's playing Lex Luthor.
Yeah, correct, correct.
Yeah, okay. Sort of appropriate, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it could pull off quite an evil,
evil nerd
mastermind. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then Jeremy Irons. Who doesn't love Jeremy Irons, right?
Oh, yeah.
He's playing Alfred Pennyworth, the butler of Batman. That's going to be fantastic.
Jeremy Irons.
Yeah,
wow.
Absolutely. And Lawrence Fishburne's going to be in this movie, playing Perry White, the newspaper editor. And there's a whole bunch of other actors that look, it looks like it's going to be fabulous, and I'm really, really looking forward to it.
I'm excited about it too, not for, Anna?
And no, I was going to say that I kind of like, when you listed, when you said the name and I saw it was like Batman versus Superman, I was like, no, I don't like when they mix things up, I'm a purist, but... when you start listing the actors, I actually kind of can see that, you know, I'm actually a big fan of Jeremy Irons. I really like him. So I was
he's fantastic.
And
it's called Batman versus Superman, but obviously where they're going to go with the plot here is they'll be against each other for whatever reason up front, and then they'll kind of find each other and they'll be buddies by the end of the movie. That's what I'm anticipating up front.
But and that's when the kiss happens.
But we want to know who's going to win, Batman versus Superman. And of course, I'm rooting for Batman because I like Batman because he's like completely human and he just has his cunning and his courage.
And he's cynical and stupid. Yeah, no, we're voting for Superman, who has no money, but
he's not even human. He's not even one of us. He's a usurper.
I think he's going to win just because he's not human. And
turn all the weapons on the world on a fucking alien renegade.
He's looking out for us, though.
So he says, how do you know he's not preparing the way for a fucking invasion force? Next time
you're in trouble, Brian, and you're calling out to Superman. Yeah.
Good point. Good, really great point, Dion. Yeah.
That's it. We'll keep you posted as we hear more. Right now, they haven't released anything about the plot yet. But they have released a glimpse of what the new Batmobile is going to look like, and it's looking good.
So grim and sleek.
It's going to be black. I'm thinking
it's going to be black, but it's not going to be sleek. It's going to be chunky.
Ooh.
And tank like. It's going to be quite cool. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that was our nerd minute. Now onto a few new stories of the week. We're going to start with our first news story. I'm reading from the CNN World site, and the headline is "Verdict Not Final for Sudanese Sentenced to Death for Her Christianity." This the Sudanese woman, she's been sentenced to death after refusing to renounce her Christianity. The government of Sudan has defended its verdict, but has trying to appease the world, who have obviously gone into an outrage about this, saying that it's only a preliminary verdict, right? So this woman is Maryam Yiha Ibrahim. She's 27. She's been accused of apostasy, or the renunciation of faith. She's 8 months pregnant. She's a Christian. But the court considers her a Muslim. So she was born into a Muslim situation. She married a Christian Ethiopian Orthodox, as far as I can remember from this this passage. And effectively, they have they've sentenced her to death under Sharia law. They've also sentenced her to 100 lashes for marrying a Christian.
It's before they kill her.
That's before they kill her. Okay.
Lovely.
So what we have here is a classic case. We've done many of these on the show. Sharia law, which is religious, ecclesiastical law of Muslim style imposed on the secular world, that have all sorts of crazy shit laws that give the death penalty for the most arbitrary of bullshit. And take people's lives away, and this woman is one of them. So, what do you guys think about that?
Let's just specify here. When we say, or when the court claims that she is a Muslim, And even if you're saying she was born into a Muslim situation, I mean, what we're saying actually is that nominally she was born into a Muslim situation, but the detail of the story is that her father, who was the Muslim, left home when she was six. And so in every meaningful sense, she was raised a Christian because her mother was a Christian.
That's right.
So to actually accuse her of apostasy is ridiculous, because unless you're proposing to reduce the age of accountability, you know, from whatever it happens to be down to the age of six, you know, you can't accuse someone of going back on what they were brought up as being. And the other thing that we should just specify here, which the devil's always in the details, if you'll excuse the supernatural reference, is that when we say, what was the other main accusation that was made here? That she committed adultery.
Yes.
Because she married this Christian guy.
Yes.
You know, the reason is actually just that the court doesn't regard her marriage to a Christian guy as legal. It's regarded as void because a Muslim cannot supposedly marry a Christian.
Correct. So therefore she was committing adultery, yeah.
You know, I mean, my mind just boggles.
It's a classic example of the desperate need for the separation of church and state. What a lot of horse shit.
It's not Sudan's not a nation state. It doesn't need to be secular.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be secular.
Talking over each other now. I think it's a classic example of interpreting a letter of the law or the spirit of the law, you know? I mean, to them it's so, like adultery doesn't mean betrayal of your marriage vows. It's just some kind of a legalistic thing that, you know, in one case, she could be, you know, perfectly legally married, but if they find some sort of a loophole in the law, suddenly she's a cheater, she's a horrible person, and she deserves to be stoned or something like that, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, it is, Mark brings up an interesting point.
But I'm suggesting is that it's not like a nation state in the way that we understand a nation state. So if you look at, we live in South Africa, Dion and I, and South Africa is full of different nations that are brought together as a nation state by certain symbols such as the flag and the passport and the fact that people call each other South Africans and support teams and whatever. And so in that sense, the nation state, the government, etc., is expected to be relatively secular. Because it's supposed to include a huge variety of like religions and cultures and language and whatever. Now the state, the Sudanese state, it's the way it's organized, the way it's created, the way it comes into being is not seen like that. It's seen as somehow as coming from Islam.
It's an ecclesiastical state.
The point I'm making is merely that
Let's talk about some of the problems here. We're talking about Sharia law. So they're a state, one of the few in the world, run on Sharia law. Okay. Here's some of the issues around religious conversion under Sharia law. If a person converts to Islam or is born and raised as a Muslim, then he or she will have the full rights of citizenship, right? So you have to be a Muslim to have full rights in this place, right?
Because it's a nation, not just a nation state. So it's like when you get Basque separatists saying, we as a nation want to have our own state recognized internationally.
Yeah, but
it comes about in a different way.
I get that. Yeah. But I mean, it's not that any of us don't understand that. It's the same as saying there's a group of, there's a family of fucking, I don't know, Mormons that have proliferated and now there are 497 of them. And the three guys at the top decide what all the rules are. And you're not allowed in or out without obeying all their rules. But everyone in the middle doesn't get a fucking say in the matter, and they've got to live through bullshit. And that's where we have a problem with it. So, I mean, look at this. Leaving Islam is a sin and a religious crime. Once any man or woman is officially classified as Muslim because of his birth or religious conversion, she'll be subject to the death penalty if she becomes an apostate. That is, they abandon her faith. That's one. Okay, so break the rules, you get killed.
I don't think that's ridiculous.
That's pretty final.
Hang on a second. I'm definitely keen to hear why you don't think that's ridiculous, I have to say.
All right. So, look, one of the things I want to do is I think we should try and understand them before we evaluate and judge them. And the idea is this is part of this group. You've been included in this group. We include you. We take you on as part of the community. They see it as a huge betrayal. It's almost like abandoning the army or, you know, calling your mother a whore or something like that. It's something that they take really, really sincerely. And I know we just want to say, oh, well, who are these madmen? But I'm...
Okay, so let's take it further, because your logic is so...
No, hang on, though.
I
want to take this... I want to extend this logic beyond that. Let's extend the logic upwards. Let's assume there's a global community of people that have all decided and determined that we believe that murder, killing people, is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they, whether they like it or not, just like the women in their community, are in the global community, whether they like it or not, and they are under the rule of global community that says if you murder someone, you are liable for your own crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
In point of fact, that's already happened. The Sharia law is in complete violation of the UN Human Rights Declaration.
That it is.
You can't just fucking say that. You have to follow our rules or we'll fucking kill you. I mean, obviously, if your rules are don't kill other people or there's some implication, some profound implication, that is an issue. And it's not that we don't understand or that people who criticize this sort of behavior don't understand that these views are held with great fervor and are, that these people believe this crazy shit. We understand that. But that's the problem. It's a bug. It's not a feature.
Well, they might be evil, but I don't think they're crazy.
No, actually, they're not evil. I think very few people are genuinely evil. But I actually...
There's a delusion at play.
Exactly. It isn't evil. They're not sociopaths or psychopaths, but they are crazy. To behave like this is delusional behavior, but they're crazy in a very, very narrow and specific sense.
Well,
they're fully functioning day-to-day life. But they believe that somebody who leaves their religion should be killed.
I don't know about them being crazy, though. I think that they're behaving in a perfectly logical fashion, based on what they're raised to believe and the kind of environment that they live in. I'm not surprised that they behave that way. To us, it looks crazy, but they're actually playing by the rules that they actually laid out themselves. So,
and that they genuinely believe. And that,
yeah, I mean, I think it's crazy stuff. Yeah. But my objection towards this whole, what I think, was it Patrick or, wait, sorry.
Mark.
Yeah, sorry. my objection to what you've said would be basically that, you said that she lived in this society and she basically benefited from it, therefore she should obey sort of the rules. Is that what you said?
No. The benefit isn't the point. It's not like she has some kind of contract or she owes them. It's the idea that she was considered a part of, it seemed as a betrayal. She's seen as a traitor.
Mm. Yeah, that I understood. So, but to me, it feels more like she didn't really have a choice. Like you said, it's like being part of the army, and then, you're seen as betraying your comrade,
co-soldiers. She was conscripted into the religion.
Right, and that's where I disagree. If you're conscripted into something and you're seen as betrayal, to me that's like, you had no choice to be there, therefore it cannot be considered a betrayal because you had no choice to be in this group. But if you did choose, then that's a different story for me. So she was born into this society. She didn't have a choice to be a Muslim. She didn't choose. She was born and they considered her a Muslim from her birth, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Nobody's born a Muslim. They just assign that label to her.
Well, I'm not sure, but I do think even according to Islam, nobody is born a Muslim. I think it's something which you need to take on voluntarily.
No. You definitely are born a Muslim.
And from the article, it's clear that she was not a Muslim from the age of six. So, as I think Charles was pointing out, you can't make a meaningful decision about, your religious preferences at the age of six. You don't know what your fucking belly button is,
So, So if it's not a betrayal, because we don't think, I mean, they might see it as a betrayal, but if you don't think that she could be, you can have join a religion unless it's voluntary and be counted as a traitor, do you think it could be considered a huge insult, like burning the flag or
I think the whole betrayal thing is correct, but it's a question of perception. I mean, the people that are, you know, freaking out about this have a particular perception and a particular perspective, and their perspective is if you are born into a Muslim country and you can be vaguely considered a Muslim and then you're overtly expressing, you know, alternative religious views, then that's it. You're out of line. You need to be killed. Though I actually think even within the context of their own legal system, the case is quite weak, given her age and the whole father situation.
I think that's a good point,
by the mother, and the fact that she's legally married to this other guy under some other jurisdiction. I mean, I think...
There's like even more bullshit on the bullshit.
I think even, you know, I mean, in any reasonable judicial system, the case would have been thrown out. But because these judicial systems are so poisoned by religion... and people become really inflamed. Then this is, of course, the other problem of religion is people become really inflamed. I'm sure there are people who see it as a betrayal.
Oh, and I'm sure that they see it as an insult as well, like you've said.
As an insult too, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, in my opinion, nobody has the right not to be offended. And I've been asserting this forever. You people can get insulted or offended at anything. You don't know. And they don't really have a right to not be offended. I think they have the right to be offended, and you have the right to say what you think, but you cannot tell me what I don't want to hear, kind of thing. You know, like, sorry.
I think that's spot on, and I think everyone has the right to a view, everyone has the right to be offended, but that's very different to the right to take someone's life when you're offended. That's very, very different, because you're now just removing every right that person has completely. And it's the other issue I have with a sort of relativistic logic on all this is that it's all very well to say somebody's really sincere in what they're doing, or really, and you know, good intentions and you know, whatever else that they might have. Hitler may have been sincere. That doesn't mean he was a class act, you know. The issue is there are objectively problematic things going on. Objectively, not subjectively. And those can be measured in real life pain, in death, in loss. And that's what's going on here. You know, how enthusiastic how passionately these people are believing their shitty beliefs is, to me, an irrelevant thing. It's like, okay, I'll take my hat off to your passion, but you're killing someone here. That's a problem.
So you don't think the punishment is proportional to the crime?
Not even in the slightest.
You don't even think it's a crime?
Exactly. There isn't... What crime? She married some guy. Okay. Well done. We know it's just fine that you're doing this, but now you're just annoying people.
Okay.
It was a good position to take.
Thanks, Mark. Next story. Just a little sideline article I've got here. Not an article, but just a link. In fact, it is an article. It's the CNN Belief blog. And it talks about the 8 worst places in the world to be religious. And effectively what it is, these are countries where this illogic you're talking about is most rampant, where being something other than what they want you to be is punishable by death or just really bad, right? So if you're interested, the algorithm they've used has given them 8 countries that are the worst places to be religious. And funnily enough, all these are religious countries, but what they're saying here is the worst place to be the wrong religion. Okay.
Yeah.
Burma. Burma have put a stranglehold on every religion except Theravada Buddhism. Okay, so unless you're a Theravada Buddhist, things are bad for you. China. We all know, we've talked about China ad hominem, but China, big clampdowns on religions of all sorts other than the state religion. Eritrea, just four religious groups are officially allowed to openly practice their faith in Eritrea. You either have to be Orthodox Christian, Sunni Muslim, Roman Catholic, or Evangelical Lutheran. That's pretty diverse. I'll give them that.
Evangelical Lutheran Reformed. Like, would that be all right? No, but fucking killing pigs.
Heaven forbid you're a humanistic atheist. I think things would be bad for you there. Iran. We all know about Iran. Yeah. North Korea. We know that's a fuck up. Saudi Arabia.
What's North Korea, though? What religion do you have there?
I'd imagine it's...
any religion.
It says human rights groups provided numerous reports that members of underground churches were arrested, beaten, tortured, and killed because of their beliefs. The authoritarian nation has jailed as many as 200,000 political prisoners, many on religious grounds. The country discourages any religious activities not sanctioned by officially recognized groups. It's very similar to China, from what I can gather in North Korea. They have this anemic state religion, and that's sort of sanctioned because they know that Big Brother's watching that like setup, and they decide how everything gets done there. So they know they're going to have no subversion within that structure. Anything outside of that structure, they distrust and shut it down.
Right.
Saudi Arabia, Sunni Islam is the official religion there. Pretty much anybody that's not Sunni Islam is going to have a hard time. Sudan, we've just talked about Sudan, and Uzbekistan.
My home country.
So it says they've got
What's the religion in Uzbekistan?
They say that technically the country's laws actually respect religious rights, but that's not what's happening on the ground. In practice, the Central Asian nation maintains strict control of its majority Muslim population, according to the State Department. The government continued to imprison individuals based on charges of extremism, raid religious and social gatherings of unregistered and registered religious communities, confiscate and destroy religious literature, including holy books, and discourage minors from practicing their faith.
So pretty serious about it.
Sorry, this is in Uzbekistan.
Yes.
So you're a Muslim, Anna, actually.
No.
What? No, don't deny it.
I'm an apostate. I have.
Don't deny it. It's fucking dangerous to deny it. Jeepers. You see.
Anyway, folk, due to time, we're going to move on a little bit. As interesting as all that is, the next news article is about a rabbi who is a teacher in a Jewish institution of some sort, and he made some statements that got him into a bit of trouble, which he has since then renounced. Let's zoom into that. Okay. Oops. A bit far my zoom in there. A rabbi at the prestigious Haredi Mir Yeshiva in Jerusalem told students recently that the government is comparable to the Jewish people's ancient enemy, the Amalekites, and that government officials should, in theory, be killed.
Someone made him very cross.
So, Mark, just putting it out there that this guy seems, it seems like he's legitimately concerned about this, and maybe he's right. They should all just be killed. So, in March, Rabbi Nissan Kaplan was discussing the special Bible reading relating to the Amalekites and noted that Rabbi Aharon Lieb Steinman, it's very German, isn't it?
In the wrong place.
The non-Hasidic Haredi ultra-Orthodox world had said that the current government should be considered Amalekites. Apparently, the guy spoke to his kids, told his kids that practically speaking, we have Amalek, all of his government, and the way is to take knives and to kill them, like with the ancient Greeks. Kaplan said. So why aren't we doing it? Because he said, I don't know who the general is to run the war. If I were to know who the general is, we'd go out with knives. This is what Rabbi Steitman said. There is a war on religion. Anyway, to cut the long story short.
Frankly, that seems like a pretty shit general, though. I mean, just knives. you might want to amp up the military armament there.
Maybe you weren't paying attention to the 1994 massacre of the Hutus and the Tutsis, because that all happened with machetes.
Yeah, there were
millions of them. Yeah. Yeah.
But, still, though, they weren't fighting the Israeli army, in fairness.
No, they're in a Krav. What he has done since then, obviously there was a bit of pressure, this got out, he's got into a bit of trouble, and he said, I'm completely against such words, they're disgusting, and I regret what I said, and I'm deeply sorry for using such examples. Can you say this in a Jewish accent for me, please?
But hang on though, you missed a bit here that I think is stunning.
Yes, tell us.
He says, I was talking to my kids, I'll do an accent. I was talking to my kids and they were saying, Daddy, maybe you should be the general. My kid, 6 years old, tells me we don't have swords in the house. Maybe a hammer is also good. I was very happy. I gave him a kiss.
I was, when I read this entire article, that is the paragraph that stood out to me the most. I was like, holy shit.
Your kid just suggested that you kill some people with a hammer and you're really
and you were very happy. Well done, son. That's a great suggestion.
Let me go get my hammer and start killing people immediately.
But it's great. This made the news and the general community said this dude is a nutter.
Yeah, he's being extreme. Yeah, you know?
There we go.
It's a positive.
Well, he is. But I mean, obviously, this big turnaround. He's like, I don't know what came over me. I don't know why I said that. And when they ask him why he said that, he was like, I really don't know why I said that. I was making a bit of fun, and it was crazy. And I obviously don't believe that bullshit. And that's all. And I sort of just
don't believe them.
I take a good big sigh and I go, oh my god! Honestly, I have to say this sort of cognitive.
I cannot believe the retraction. Not with the story, the little fucking anecdote with the kid. And I said to my kid said, let's kill them all with hammers, Dad.
Yeah, now I regret it. Yeah. No, but it's like he's only sorry because he got caught and he got criticized. If he didn't get criticized, he would have said nothing. He wouldn't have apologized.
Yeah.
So, Mark, what do you reckon? Too much mercury in the gefilte fish? Or maybe too many hormones in the blintzes?
I think maybe the canadlach were too heavy.
But I meet people like this every day. I mean, you know our situation in South Africa. We've come out of a long legacy of racism. We're still living in the dying throes of that bullshit. And there are still certainly where in some of the areas I work, certainly still some strongholds of strong racist sentiment. And the kind of stuff you'll hear around the coffee table is exactly that kind of bullshit, you know? Like just horrific, like, stories about how someone said something to their black maidservant, or, like, what their kids do, or just their basic sentiment against people that are different from them. And then, of course, the moment you press the issue or ask them about it, or the moment someone else enters the room, there's a complete turnaround. No, of course, you know, black people are fine. You know, they're fine as long as I don't have to touch them, look at them, talk to them, or work with them. They're fine.
So,
you know.
Yes.
A question, sorry. Does this sort of racism, does it go both ways? Does the black community as well have this whole, like, oh, white people and blah, 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 you know, don't mingle with them?
We have a politician called Malema, and this guy, he's been banned from politics. He's got up on public television on numerous occasions and had very anti-white sentiments to share publicly. And was to the great relief of all South Africans, banished from the party, from the African National Congress, who are the majority ruling party in South Africa. So he was banished from this party and also taken to court, and he was prohibited from practicing politics for the next X number of years. And suddenly, we had our election, by the way, 2 weeks ago, our national election. And he was back in the runnings. He's got his party, and not only did he come back in, but he got quite a big percentage. He was the number three party on the ballot list.
Yeah. He's an extremist.
An extremist and certainly captures the attention of the reverse sentiment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we have it both ways, definitely. Folk, let's move on to our last article, and then we'll see what Anna has for us today. Our last little article, folk, is about a girl who, a girl in San Francisco. She goes to the Sacred Heart Cathedral Preparatory School, a Catholic school, and they were busy taking photos of all the students for the school yearbook. And she went and got her photo taken in a tuxedo with a tie. She seems to be gay. She has a girlfriend, or bi, or something not
traditional
in her sexual orientation. And the school declared that they would not put her photo in the yearbook. So she's been left out of the yearbook because of this.
Well, she wanted to be in the picture wearing a tuxedo.
Yes.
So it was the problems with the photo.
Yeah, the problems with the photo. Okay. So they decided to leave her photo out of the yearbook. And what's happened since then is there's been a bit of a sort of outcry from the rest of the student body who are all supporting her. They all came to school or have been coming to school in ties. So they got their casual clothes on and they're wearing ties. And this is in support of their friend who, after the school coming back to them and saying, well, look, we'll review the whole thing and see if we're happy with letting this through, have made a final decision that they're not putting her photo in because that is the school rule, that the girls have to wear dresses in photos, in the yearbook. And, but they have said that they will re-look at the school ruling on it and possibly, you know, for to change it. To give them credit, they have come out and they've been very like, we have no problem with whatever sexual orientation you may be and we don't mind, but we want our girls to be in dresses.
It's understandable.
You know.
I think it's understandable. We had at my school, if you wanted to have your photos taken for the class photo, you had to wear your blazer and your tie. They had school rules. And I think what's going on with this school is probably that they have an image that they want to be traditional and conservative. And that's what the parents are expecting. And that's the ethos that they have. And part of the way they do this is through the symbols of dress. And she was undermining that.
That's true.
No, I mean, I'm sympathetic to that view. I'm sympathetic to it, but I'm also very sympathetic to any pushback on religious efforts to, you know, make people conform. So I'm more sympathetic to her view. I really don't give a shit what the school's reasons are.
I would still
push tooth and nail. Although, yeah, I get what you're saying, and that may actually be part of their reasoning, but fuck them is the way I feel about it, really.
Yeah, exactly. So they're a conservative school, and, you know, they have their rules, and that's people should follow those rules if they want to be in that school, fine. But like Brian, I'm saying basically, yeah, fuck them. Fuck all these stupid orthodox, you know, schools with their strict gender, rules where, you know, a girl cannot be a girl without wearing a skirt. I mean, that's ridiculous. And, you know, they're enforcing their view, onto the students. So.
And it's good to see the students pushing back. I mean, I think it's a good exercise in public expression.
Sedition.
Yeah, and sedition. Yeah, a little bit of sedition, as long as it doesn't get nasty or violent, is always great, really, in my view.
But look, as a guy, you know, I think all girls should wear skirts.
I can enforce it.
As a girl, I want all guys to be pantless.
Pantless.
I hope you're okay with that. Say,
I concur.
Pantless. Yeah,
no trouserless. Yeah. The nicest thing anybody's ever said to me was, Mark, I wish you never had to wear trousers.
Just t-shirts.
I'd like to drill down into this a little bit because it's hard to know what the standards are for the guys, for example. Where the guys, I mean, I'm listening to Mark's argument and I really think it's a valid argument. At the same time, it then needs to be consistent. So, because from the picture that's attached to the story, so I really like Mark's argument, and I'm actually not at all against the idea of a closed community setting its own standards and upholding those standards. But if you look at the photo of these other kids who are supporting this girl who wore the tux in her photo, they're all going to school, they're all wearing civvies, along with the ties that they're, by which they're showing their support for her. I just wonder whether, the same standards were required of the guys. So I guess, what I'm saying is this standard being applied equitably? And, if the school had a uniform, I think it would be a whole lot easier for them to say, well, we're trying to uphold the standard and this is the image we're trying to project and so on and so forth. Whereas in this case, it seemed pretty clear from the photo of her classmates that, these kids are going to school in shorts and sneakers and t-shirts. So I'm just wondering, how meaningful it is to apply an arbitrary rule either just to girls or either just, in the case of the yearbook, that girls have to wear skirts to have their photo taken for the yearbook. Given that it doesn't even seem to be a school where uniforms are worn. I'm not against the argument. I'm just saying it seems to be applied a little bit arbitrarily. And what does it actually mean in that context?
Yeah. it's sort of like there's the reality and then there's the yearbook. And they're two different things with two different rules.
Well, it's a formal thing, the yearbook. Yeah. It requires a different kind of propriety.
But, if you think about it, I'm talking about getting married in a few months' time, and I'm going to absolutely insist that everybody's in costume. And if you want to walk around the streets with pickets saying, we will not be treated, unfairly because we don't want to wear hobbit outfits at your wedding. Well, you are more than welcome to do that, but you still aren't coming to my wedding without a costume.
Like a speedo.
But it's like, I get that argument, but is this school, this is a private school or something, or what is it?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Okay, maybe that's why, because the public school could never get away with it.
No, but that's a different thing. Yeah,
the public school needs to be secular because
so
it needs to.
I'm going to end this with a joke. So my daughter goes to St. Anne's School in Hilton, about one block from where Charles lives. And on the day she arrived there, they called an assembly and got all the new girls together. And the principal stood up and said, "Okay, girls, welcome to St. Anne's and." You must understand it's a very highfalutin private school, right? If you've ever seen something like Dead Poets Society, you'll get a sense of the school we're talking about. And they called them all together and she said, we have a few elocution lessons to go through today, and we'd like you all to repeat after me, please. Everyone say, air. So all the girls went,
air.
Thank you. And would you all join me, please? Everyone
all right,
say
yeah,
air.
Yeah.
Air.
Now, would you all please say hair?
Hair.
Hair.
Now, would you all please say lair?
Lair.
Now, everybody say it all together. Air. Hilaire.
Air. Hilaire.
Sorry about that. Okay.
Did that actually happen?
No.
Oh,
you just wanted to fuck with us and made us.
I just had to put it in.
That would have been great, though, because I mean, that would have been a great headmistress just to illustrate. Look, we don't really stand in ceremony here.
That's beautiful. Although she did come back with that joke from school the first day, so it's obviously a going joke for the newbies. So, Anna, what do you have to tell us about this week?
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, the Earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall. We built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery.
The scientific mysteries of Anna Kubieva.
Yes. Okay. So, couple of my friends sent me a link to this cool new movie that's coming out very soon, and it's called Interstellar. Have you guys heard about it?
I have heard about it. I want to see it. I want to see it right now.
That's the one with the bubble.
Yes.
With the bubble.
It's uber cool. And, well, first of all, it's got Matthew McConaughey in it. Or how do you say his name? Matthew McConaughey. Matthew McConaughey. And I'm just like, I melt when I see him. Anyway, no. But,
so did you like Mad Mike?
Didn't see Mad Mike, actually. Saw this recent show, series
True Detective.
Called True Detective, yes. And he was amazing in that show. So yeah, that's basically, I was like, oh, wow, Matthew McConaughey. So anyway, so he's in this film. He plays some dad of a family who is also an astronaut and an engineer or something like that. Anyway, and I think the movie is about international travel because apparently, to summarize it, something went wrong on Earth, basically ran out of food or something due to probably global warming or some such like that.
He's dying or any of the number of actual things that are fucking happening right
yes,
now.
Yes, yes. Something Noble is bacon. Terrible, and it looks pretty good. And one of the reasons it looks so good is because an article that I linked, it is recognized as being fairly close to how interstellar travel would look like or be the way it's portrayed. It seems rather realistic. You know, it's a very small teaser. You don't really see that much, but there's a picture of some giant sphere. Somebody mentioned that just when I mentioned the film. And the sphere represents this warped space-time sort of gravitational lensing bubble thingy that happens when very massive object, like when you look at a very massive object. And in the article, there's even a link to an actual photograph that we took of this phenomenon happening where a galaxy is so massive, it causes such a huge distortion in space-time that you can see objects behind it distorted and repeated all over in a circle around it in this kind of sphere. So you see this, let's say there was a pulsar or a quasar behind the galaxy, and you can see it magnified and repeated around in this lens. So anyway, theoretically, this travel, interstellar travel, is actually possible. But I don't know if many... there was a news story, I think last year, about the possibility of interstellar travel using this... faster than light travel drive thingy. I don't know what it's called.
Hyperdrive.
I think so, something like that. And many people said that, you know, it's the energy that you would need to create the engine to make a ship, a fairly small ship, to go at the speed of light, or is it 10 times the speed of light or something. It's so massive, it would be the size of Jupiter or something like that. So that's basically, it's possible, but it's technically unfeasible for us. Might as well be impossible. But in the latest research done by Mr. Dr. White, I don't remember his first name. Let's see. His name is Dr. Harold Sonny White, and he works at the Advanced Propulsion at the Advanced Propulsion Team Lead for NASA Engineering Directorate. And he's doing research, they're putting money into this, to figure out how to create this theoretical drive, because theoretically it's possible. And they actually devised an engine that is smaller than Jupiter, basically, and it theoretically will be possible to travel at about 10 times the speed of light, which is pretty insane, actually.
Times the speed of light, okay.
10 times, yes.
It would still take you, well, I suppose... several months to reach Alpha Centauri. Still up better than 4 years, I guess.
They mentioned like that you could travel in about 2 weeks to what was it? Gliese 581 G, a planet similar to Earth, which is about 20 light years away from our planet, and you'll be able to reach it in 2 years. And
in 2 years,
According to the article, that's actually not a very long time, because we know many of our famous explorers on Earth, for example, Magellan, circumnavigated the globe in about 3 years. Of course, he probably stopped off at some island to pick up some food or whatever.
Yeah.
Would you go?
Yeah. Holy shit, yeah, I would totally go.
Yeah, I'd go in a heartbeat.
Yeah, in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I'm reading an article here, Scientific American, about this research. And it seems that, one of their statements here is the complications seem as endless as space itself. They're talking about things like the dust, space dust, and how with any measure of travel through space, that space dust, although it's tiny and would cause small damage over those sort of distances, would just be devastating.
Over those distances and at that speed.
Yes.
But that's what shields would be for. I mean, and not sort of namby-pamby fluffy shields. So I suppose electromagnetic shields would probably buffer you against most of that stuff. You know, because if there was any kind of, if there was any kind of magnetic content to the dust, they would then swoop around the ship, I suppose. I mean, that's the whole point of having shields.
Yeah, stop being such a defeatist. Let's go.
Let's go.
Yeah, we're going. Don't spare the horses.
Didn't we do an article about the probe to Venus, or was it Mercury? No, Mercury, where they're using as their shield the feces of the astronauts. Because so what they do is the astronauts defecate and they spit them in these bags and they put the poo all around the spaceship because apparently it's like really good at deflecting certain of the gamma rays or whatever the hell it is that's beating up against this spacecraft. So
exactly,
there's
think about that. If you were a gamma ray, do you really want to go through several years of shit? Yeah. I mean, who wants to do that?
Hulk smash. I think even on a spaceship, I think on spaceship, even shit is probably precious. I don't think you want to waste it, you probably want to recycle it somehow.
International Space Station, they do recycle stuff like that. They definitely recycle urine, and I think they recycle the other stuff too.
But poo, what do you do? Yeah, mix with sugar and
what?
Flour?
Like for building Lego toys what the hell?
No, I think you put it in, there's some kind of, you combust it in an oven and then just break all the component parts apart. The key thing is to get any liquid back, any nutrients back. That remain in the shit.
Delightful, delightful.
Yeah, but once it's been cooked at a certain temperature, any bacteria or unpleasantness has been dealt with, then it's just desiccated material, and you reclaim all the water, and then you brush your teeth with it. I guess I'm pretty certain that's precisely what happens.
So I think to wrap it up, I have to make some kind of a segue into the Bible or something. So yeah, there's nothing in space travel in the Bible. So
Hold on. Totally wrong on that.
What about Lucifer falling from heaven?
What about the Scientology?
Don't forget Ezekiel's vision of the animals. I mean,
the atmosphere. Come on. What?
And what about the seven heavens?
Yeah, that's like the atmosphere, the seven layers of atmosphere or something. That's not space.
What about in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth?
Checkmate, I think.
Well, depends on how you define. Well, anyway,
And just to make it more confusing, he created light and darkness and then created the sun. So,
but that is how the Big Bang happened, isn't it? Like,
in the beginning, God made it. God said that there'd be light.
There we go. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to us talking cuck all night. And this podcast is Primordial Soup. Where can you find us? You can find us on SoundCloud. more particularly, soundcloud.com/primordial-soup, S-O-U-P. And over there you'll find all our episodes. This is episode 57. You can also download us on iTunes if you have a, if you just do a search on the iTunes blogs, you'll find us there. You can subscribe to the RSS feed. We also have a website which hopefully will get cracking and up and running again in the next week or so with updated links and information. We'll update all our personal information and so forth. Hosts have changed over the last 8 months. And we'll get everything up and going. And I think if Mark is up to the task, we'd like to see Mark a bit more often. What do you think?
Glory. Amen.
Wonderful. So,
Mark and his beard.
Behold.
From myself, Dion Barnard, and my good friends Brian Coughlin and Charles Webster and Anna Kupreva and Mark Ryan Reese, we say good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Nighty night.
May you dream of victory.